Welcome. This is the hashtag STRask podcast. I'm Amy Hall, here for Stand to Reason, and I'm here with Greg Kokel to answer your questions that you send us on Twitter with the hashtag STRask. So you ready to get going, Greg?
Ready to go.
All right. Here's a question from James. Why do you think some prayers are unanswered despite their heartfelt, sincere, and unselfish motives? For example, the healing of a spouse, child, friend, or marriage.
Man, I wish I had an answer to that question. You know, there's a crazy response Yogi Berra gave once. I think he said, I wish I had an answer to that question because I'm tired of answering it or something like that. But I don't know for myself. I mean, every single Christian faces this problem. This is another why didn't God type of question. I don't know. Now, I know some things that can be hindrances to prayer. I mean, David says, if I regard iniquity in my heart, then God won't hear me. I think that's Psalm, 32 or something like that. You read in James that sometimes we ask with wrong motives, although the way the question was worded, that isn't the case there in the way it was described. 1 Peter says that husbands have their prayers hindered when they are not respectful or gracious or kind to their wives. So we see these different things that can get in the way. And also maybe we don't persist long enough. That's another indication from something Jesus says in the gospel. So, I mean, there are the different types of things. But I know that there have been things that, you know, I prayed about for years and years that are deeply significant. And, you know, sometimes you see a little nudge here and there or the immovable rock, you know, moves a little bit. But, you know, a lot of times it just feels like the heavens are brass. And I ask the question, exactly the same question. And my appeals are just as described, they're heartfelt and genuine and other-oriented and passionate and with loud wailing and tears, you know, talks about Hebrews, I guess. So, and what? Nothing, it seems, regarding certain issues. So I can't answer that question except for in the very general way that I just did. If there's nothing that's impeding the prayer itself, nothing on our side that's getting in the way, then the only thing that's getting in the way is the secret will of God and the secret determinations of God. And he's just simply saying, either not yet, and this is why we should, anything important, we should never give up praying on something important. And may it never be said of me that I have not because I ask not. But we shouldn't, it's either not yet or no. And we won't know if it's no until our lives are over or the person's life is over who we're praying for. I don't know. Sometimes it just becomes really obvious that this isn't going to change and God is just saying no for a different reason. God said no to Paul. Mm-hmm. Three times he appealed and God said no, and he had a reason. And Paul talks about the reason there. Now, what's nice in Paul's case is Paul was told the reason. we don't have that kind of access. So we can take encouragement from Paul's conversation there, are comments in 2 Corinthians, where he talks about the thorn in his flesh, that there are reasons that may be beyond our comprehension, and God knows. And we leave it there. And that's a phrase, by the way, that I have repeated hundreds and hundreds and thousands, really, of times in my life, especially in the last recent years. God knows. You're stuck. You don't know what's going on. You're looking around. You say, what the heck is up with this? And I have to say, well, God knows. God knows. That means he's in control. He's covering it. And not to worry, Greg. So I'm counseling myself, God knows.
Yeah, unless God were to give a specific answer, as he did to Paul, there is no way we could know why any one specific prayer, the specific reasons why it wasn't answered. And that's when our trust comes in and our understanding of who God is comes in. But I will, just to give some thoughts about how to think about this, even when you don't know why you're not getting a specific answer. One thing to keep in mind is that we judge failures by whether or not they accomplish what they're meant to accomplish. So if we say that someone failed to create a working television, we would judge that by whether or not it was acting as a television. So the ends that are in mind are the way that you judge whether or not the failure happened. So
good.
One thing that we do know, we know that God has two great goals for people right now and for this world. The two goals that we know of from the Bible are his glory and our good. So in terms of his glory, sometimes his glory is revealed by answering the prayers that the way we ask them. But sometimes his glory is revealed by teaching us to know him better, to depend on him better. You mentioned Paul in 2 Corinthians 1:8-9. He says that they despaired even of life so that they would learn to trust in God who raises the dead.
Right.
Through our prayers not being answered in the way that we would like them to, sometimes he makes himself known to others, to the world. Sometimes he draws people to himself through that. His glory is being revealed, and we know that everything that he's working in this world is working for that end. So that's something that we can trust even when we're not getting the answer that we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, I talk about Ephesians 2 all the time, but Ephesians 2, 4, and 7 – it talks about how his goal, he will show us the riches of his grace for eternity. So as we're living in weakness, in sorrow, in ways that force us to depend on him and learn to figure out who he is, that will affect our ability to rejoice in his grace forever. So his glory, and by the way, I said his glory and our good, but his glory is our good. Our seeing his glory is also our good. Mm-hmm. But secondly, we also know from Romans 8 that he's working all things together for our good. But he defines that in the very next verse.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed this out.
Christ.
Good for you, Amy. Right, right.
So he is working in our lives to make us like Christ. And sometimes we're praying for things that will make us more comfortable, make us happier, make us more joyful, when in reality, God wants us to stay unhealed as he did Paul for mm-hmm. a specific reason that he can make us like Christ.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, everything that God's doing is working towards his glory and our good. And I think there are a couple reasons why we don't understand his answers. And the first reason is that we just have limited knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
God sees so much more than we do. He sees how he's accomplishing those two things through his answers to our prayers and seeming non-answers to our prayers. But we don't have that knowledge. So that's one reason why we might not understand what he's doing. And secondly, we might just have a lesser goal in mind. Our goal might be, like I said, our goal might be comfort. Our goal might be an ease in distress. But God has a greater goal. God has two greater goals, his glory and our good. And so when we have a lesser goal in mind, his answers won't make sense to us.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think at the end of time, when we're looking back, I think all these questions will be answered. I think mm-hmm. we will see what he was doing, not just in our lives, but in the lives of everybody around us.
That's a really good point. In fact, it isn't always at the end of time that we get to see this. Most of us can look back in our lives and we see now things we had desired and asked God to do, and indeed God was doing something differently that we are now aware of. And we think, oh man, am I glad God didn't let me marry that girl? You know, oh my goodness gracious me, you know, based on hindsight. And so mm-hmm. now we can say, now I can see why God didn't answer that prayer for my good, as you pointed out. So that's one way the question is answered. Why didn't God answer? Well, sometimes in hindsight, after a long period of time, sometimes we look back and see there was a bigger plan in place that God was working out, and we're thankful that he did not give us the stone we were praying for, you know, essentially. We asked for bread, but it turns out to be a stone, you know, and Jesus said he's not going to do that.
And incidentally, every time we see something like that, Greg, because I think we can all point to things like that in our lives where we're grateful God didn't answer
right.
prayers the way we wanted. Every time that happens, that increases our trust in the areas where we don't see anything yet. We don't see any reason yet. But, you know, faith is hard. And by faith, I mean trust, our continued trust in God, who has proven himself over time, not just in our lives, but in all of history, to be trustworthy. It's still when that pain or the emotions are on you, it's very difficult to trust in who he is.
Yeah.
But that's what we're called to do.
Yeah.
All right, Greg, let's go on to a second question. And it's a completely different question.
All right.
Sometimes we have questions that go together.
Uh-huh.
This is a completely different one. And it's kind of an unusual one that comes from Matthew. If a man in a polygamous marriage converts to Christianity, what should he do about his wives, given that the biblical ideal is one man to one woman?
Yeah. I don't know that I'm qualified to give a good answer here. This is a circumstance that Christians face in Africa and in Muslim countries where polygamy is practiced in some sense, some cases. And I'm not sure what the best circumstance is. But I think it might be helpful to look at how God took care of or how we dealt with circumstances similar to this in the Old Testament. Now, we are aware that sometimes God gives directives that do not reflect the ideal, but reflect an appropriate improvement on the circumstances when the ideal is not reasonably available. I think slavery is an example of that, where God sanitized slavery, which it was to a large degree in the Old Testament was indentured servanthood. So it wasn't slavery in the sense that we think of slavery in America. But it was certainly an upgrading and improving thing. What I say is that under the Mosaic Law, so-called slaves had union representation. You know, that was Moses and the directives that were given there. So it was certainly an improvement, though it wasn't ideal. And it wasn't until later that slavery then itself using and advancing Christian principles was brought to an end, at least in the Western world. And so same thing with polygamy. There was polygamy in the Old Testament. But this was part of practiced in the culture there, and it wasn't ideal. Pardon me. It wasn't ideal, but it was an improvement, maybe God's directives improved on things, just like a certificate of divorce. God hates divorce, but he gave a provision that protected the woman in the case of a man leaving her. Okay, so I think fast forward now to present day, where you have someone in an African country who has a number of wives and becomes a Christian. What's he going to do? He's got a number of wives, maybe children from each of these wives that he is supporting, and man, they're part of their home and their family. It's not ideal. I mean, polygamous marriages had all kinds of problems, infighting, whatever, and we see that in the Old Testament. But to essentially divorce all but one casts the rest of his family out to do what? And sometimes this results in prostitution. That's the only thing that's available. There's no safety net. And so I think this is a circumstance where you don't get the ideal. What you do is you get something less than ideal because the ideal is not possible to have without creating a greater harm to other people. This has to be assessed on an individual basis. And it might be that it's possible to have one wife and make some adjustments and get the ideal, but we don't demand that, I think, is the best way to look at it.
Yeah, I think, Greg, there are probably missionaries out there who have thought about this much more carefully. But this could be something that we will need to think about. I mean, it could be possible in the future that there will be polygamy here again. And then
yeah.
This is something we have to
or polyamory, which is even more complex because it doesn't isn't one man, many wives, but it's many, many men, many women, you know, whatever you want, you know.
One thing I will say is that what is clear is that they are not supposed to be in leadership. So the one of the qualifications for elder is that they would have one wife. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But I think I agree with you, Greg. I don't think divorce in this case is something that improves the situation. Mm-hmm. It would his not being allowed to be in leadership is an indication to the rest of the society that this is not the ideal of what we want. But neither is it's divorce. Now, these are real marriages. This is a man and a woman who have pledged themselves together in covenant. So it's not like this is it's not a real marriage just because there's more than one in this case. This it's actually it would be a real divorce and it would be it would improve things.
There are real women and real children
right.
that are involved here as well.
Now, like I said, this is something we're going to have to think about. One thing that did come to mind, Greg, is, and I was trying to think how this might relate or not relate, because there is one place in the Bible where people were commanded to divorce their wives. Mm-hmm. And that was after the return from the exile, when the people had started marrying foreign wives in direct disobedience to their covenant, they had started to marry foreign wives and they had to divorce them. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think this is really analogous to the situation just because.
I agree.
First of all, the purpose of this law in the Mosaic Covenant was to protect the culture that would bring about the Messiah. It was so that they would not be drawn away into these foreign into these foreign gods to worshiping them, which, by the way, had been the cause of their exile in the first place.
Right.
They were exiled because they had gone after these foreign gods. And many times this would happen because their hearts were drawn away because of their spouse. Mm-hmm. So this was a very serious thing for the purpose of Israel under the Mosaic Covenant. And so they had broken that. And in that case, the situation was that it was better to divorce. It was worse to stay married in disobedience in a way doing the very thing that had caused their exile.
Right. And this is a case, as you pointed out, where they are acting in direct violation of the command of God for them. As mm-hmm. opposed to the circumstance described here, somebody becomes a Christian who is already married to other people. It's a totally different kind of circumstance. And also the danger is different too, as you pointed out. The theocracy needed to be protected. This is why the laws were given. It created a dividing wall, it says in Ephesians chapter 2, that separated the Gentiles from the Jews. So there wasn't syncretism between the theology of the Jews that God had given them and also these foreign gods that the women always brought in. They bring their idols, you know, and that was just part of the package. This was the downfall of Solomon, by the way, and the downfall of Solomon resulted in the civil war in his next generation with Jeroboam and Rehoboam, and the nation split into the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And so, I mean, look at the consequences there. Solomon did not end well. And the reason he didn't end well is he disobeyed God, married all of these foreign women who brought in their foreign gods. It was a mess. And this is exactly what God is trying to protect the Jews from in the circumstance that you raised as they're returning from exile.
And by the way, just so it's not unclear, the problem wasn't that the women were foreign. The problem was that the women were part of that foreign culture worshiping these foreign gods.
That's right.
When you look at someone like Ruth, She was a foreigner, but she followed the true God, and she's actually in the line of Christ. So the problem was a moral one and an unfaithfulness to God one, not a problem of, oh, they're not Jews.
Yeah, that's right.
So I just want to make that clear.
Yeah, that's a good point. Rahab as well.
Oh, and Rahab, right.
Same thing. I mean, she was a prostitute who is a Canaanite and a Philistine or whatever, and she became part of the community of the Jews and also on the lineage to Christ.
And the lesson to us in this is, as fallen people, the pull of the culture is so strong and so dangerous. We have to be so careful. But thankfully for us, we don't just have a law. Now we have the Spirit inside of us who gives us the power to resist these unfaithful acts towards God. And so that's something we can be really thankful for now. And let's hope we never have to deal with the polygamy issue in our culture. But who knows? Who knows what will be coming? And we're going to have to all think very wisely and carefully about all of this. All right. Well, thank you, Greg. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. We appreciate hearing from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.